Sail on, silver girl. Good morning and welcome to a Red River Radio Spotlight. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and opening up today at the Robinson Film Center with multiple showings throughout the coming week is a brand new documentary called The Wrecking Crew, an in-depth look at the musicians behind some of the music of America's greatest hit records from one of its most creative times. And today and tonight, there's a special screening at 7:30 that will feature a reception and a Q&A session with bassist Joe Osborne, a member of this famous musical family. And joining me this morning in our Knoll Foundation studios is Joe Osborne, and he's going to tell us a little bit about both the times and the creation of this documentary and the music behind it. Joe, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, you know, when a lot of people hear the records from that area, they think, you know, the Mamas and the Papas, they were a group out front. But what they don't realize a lot of times is that what was going on behind the scenes was a whole nother group of musicians that were laying down the tracks and creating in the studios. And you were part of one of those groups, and there were a bunch of them around the country. There was the Funk Brothers in Motown, the Wrecking Crew out in L.A., of course, the Memphis Brass and Soul Sound, and a number of others. But these were really the musicians behind much of the greatest music that really came out of our pop and rock era. Can you tell us how you ended up out in L.A. and got a part of this Wrecking Crew, and then we'll go into the documentary tonight?
Well, my close friend James Burton, there's a two-year story that goes leading up to this, but he came. I was playing in a joint out in Bossier City with Jerry Hawkins, and James came in, and he didn't know I had become a bass player at the time. He said, "Ricky's putting the band back together if you want to come and play."
And that would be Ricky Nelson, right?
Ricky Nelson. And I said, "Well, of course." And so 2 weeks later, James Burton took me out of that bar and put me where I needed to be in Los Angeles as a bass player in a situation that would get me noticed, which is the only way it could have worked. You people say, "How do you get into this, into that?" I said, "Well, you really don't unless somebody takes you in."
Right.
You can't go in and say, "I play pretty good, give me a shot." That never happens.
You really got to get noticed somehow, somewhere, by one of these, you know, mega producers or somebody.
So James Burton gave me that.
Yeah.
And from there, I got noticed.
Because before that, you had been a guitar player, you were playing up in Chicago, you were playing around here, and you were playing out in Vegas, but you ended up in a band where there were two guitar players, and they put you on the bass. Is that how the story goes?
Yeah, that's right. Well, early in that, me and Roy Buchanan were playing the guitars with a country singer in Las Vegas named Bob Blumen. And at some point we said, "Well, one of us needs to play bass." And so I was elected. I was guitar player one night. The next night I'm the bass player. Now I've got the right instrument in my hand.
Right.
I had to be a bass player in Los Angeles to have been involved in what I was involved in. So that long circle, full circle back to Bossier City, and it was a long, winding circle.
And up in Chicago, you were playing, seven, eight nights a week for about 8 hours. So you kind of, you know, baptism by fire, so to speak.
Right. Oh, yeah. We were working eight sets a night. Start at 8 p.m. and get off at 4, 7 days a week. But I realized after, I was learning how to play the bass, and I was getting chops playing that much. You get iron fingers.
Right.
So it wasn't but a few months after that, wound up back in Bossier City. That was the full circle, and James Burton put me where I needed to be.
So out in Ricky Nelson's. Now, you went to Australia with Ricky Nelson, did you not? And didn't Fender give you a particular bass guitar just as your instrument for that trip?
Yeah. How fast that whole thing escalated. It was just a few months after I started in the band. It was in summer of 1960. And by the early 61, we recorded Traveling Man, the biggest record Ricky ever had. Mm-hmm. And that put us on the road. Went to Australia and Philippines and Hong Kong and all around. And, Fender, yeah, they heard about that trip coming up. They wanted all their new stuff to go on that trip. So they sent out jazz bass. Nobody ever heard. It was all, you know, that old precision bass. Right, that's what I started playing. This new bass and an amp, and it came from Fender.
Yeah, okay. Now, can you go into a little bit? I mean, you've worked with some really just superb studio musicians behind the scene. Can you just give us an idea of what it's like to go into the studio back then? You don't even know what the music is necessarily that you're going to be playing, but you're in the studio and you're ready to work, and you've got all of this talent around you. What's that? I mean, what does that feel like back then for you?
Well, my feeling, Hal Blaine recommended me after we played together a couple of times, and was a big help in that, in getting on into that. And he had already been doing these things for 10 years before everybody else. So I'm all brand new, for instance, if there was some looseness in between the drums and the bass, it couldn't possibly be Hal Blaine's fault, you know. Right. And I felt inferior to everybody else in the studio at first, you know, until I figured out, well, I'm playing on a few hit records here. Maybe I'm doing something right, you know.
So at that time, you really had no idea, I guess, sitting there in the studio, that 30 years, 40 years later, that would really be considered, I guess, from my standpoint as somebody who grew up with that music, as kind of the golden age of American pop and rock music. I mean, so much that is still being played on the radio today. I mean, the only reason we have a classic rock station is because that music is still so popular across generations.
Well, of course, we didn't have any idea what it would turn into be. We were just working a lot, and most of the time we didn't hear the finished record until it came out on the radio. You know, so we'd do this record with somebody, then we'd go and do 100 other sessions, and then one day you hear, after they've added the whole world onto it, the orchestra and the vocals and the backgrounds and that sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we never even had any idea how what we were doing was going to turn out to be.
So now we have a documentary that really, it started as a project in 1995, and the son of one of the guitarists wanted to, I guess, chronicle his father had developed cancer, and he kind of wanted to get some of this information down at that time. And back in the 90s, documentary was kind of a dirty word in the film business, because a lot of times you don't make a lot of money off of documentaries. But now he's created this wonderful document called The Wrecking Crew, which is going to be playing tonight and next week at the Robinson. What was your particular role? I know you were interviewed throughout for this documentary. How did you help him, you know, develop this, and what was your role in this documentary?
Well, you know, Denny, his father, Tommy Tedesco, a top guitar player in Los Angeles, worked with a lot. It was started out to be a documentary about Tommy.
Yeah.
And when he started to talk to people that worked with Tommy a lot, he realized there was more to it than that. So that expanded to the group and the people that did all those records. That thought really wasn't in his mind at the first.
Yeah.
And he might not have even realized that how small that group was when he started. He found that out as he talked to everybody, what we did. We did this group's records, we did that group's records. Oh, my role was just to be there and answer questions.
Just kind of the background information. But yeah. I think, you know, we were talking about before the interview about serendipity and just kind of life just happening to you in unexpected ways. And it seems like that's really how this whole documentary kind of developed. He wanted to chronicle some of what his dad had done before his dad had passed away. And then he realized that he was really talking about a whole history and an era, and it blew up into this really fabulous documentary.
Yeah. And he realized that just from started to talk to people. And the name Wrecking Crew came from Hal Blaine. He had written a book about Phil Spector and the musicians that played with Phil Spector, and called it the Wrecking Crew. So, well, then he realized, with talking with Denny, that, all right, well, that there's more to that than that.
Right. You know? So he ended up uncovering all of these musicians. Now, can you give us some of the names of the musicians that you worked with that were the behind-the-scenes kind of masterminds of all of these great hits?
As the Wrecking Crew, doing what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Well, there's Larry Nechtel, Hal Blaine, Mike Dacey, Dennis Buttermer, Tommy Tedesco.
And the jazz guitarist Larry Carlton was with you there for a while, and also Leon Russell was part of the Wrecking Crew for a while as well.
They were in the beginning of all that. Larry came in a little later, and me and Hal helped to get him started. Mm-hmm. Just recommended we liked playing with him, and so we brought some of those people in just by recommending. Yeah, the producer sometimes would say, "Who, you guys heard a new guitar player you like?" Yeah. We know one.
So, you know, you're out in L.A., you're hearing a lot of different musicians play. So, as you said, you've kind of get noticed. So you're actually a part of that process now of noticing other guitar. I know you've worked with Matthew Davidson here in town and noticed his chops. And it kind of is a give back kind of a situation for a lot of musicians. You get noticed and you say, well, I've got this buddy over here who's really good too. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of, you know, folds and rolls downhill that way.
Well, see, that's part of the answer to the question, how do you get started in being a studio player? Well, somebody's got to bring you in.
Mm-hmm. And somebody who brought you in was James Burton. And now, when when Denny Tedesco first started this documentary, when did he actually get around to first interviewing you?
I know exactly when that was. I had talked to him for quite a while, and we were just having trouble getting together. It was in 2005, during James Burton's Guitar Festival. That was the first one of those he had.
Yeah.
So I was over there playing. Johnny Rivers was coming in, and he asked if I'd be there. The Nelson Twins were coming. They wanted me to play behind them. So Denny found out about that. So he came to Shreveport and came over there, and that was our first meeting.
Okay. So, and from there, obviously he interviews you, he gets ideas for other thoughts, and it just kind of sprawls out from there.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, tell us about, you're going to be there tonight and tomorrow night doing a question and answer session, and you've seen the documentary, so give us your impressions of the documentary. Obviously, it can't capture everything, but what are the highlights from your point of view of this documentary? What are you really glad is in there and is spotlighting some talent that maybe was unsung at the time?
Well, the point of the film is to say that all these groups that had all these monster records didn't play on their record.
Right.
It was all us.
And they were just the voices, really. I mean, singing the lyrics, but
yeah, sure.
But the rest of the music behind that was what you guys created in the studio.
They didn't play. Even some of them, like the Monkees, they actually played.
Yeah.
On stage, they didn't play on the record, but then there were a lot of groups who were just vocal, and then they would have a band that would travel with them.
Right.
Well, the Carpenters, I knew them when they were still kids in high school, had a really good band, Richard being a perfectionist. Those kids had to learn what we did in the studio, and they learned it perfectly. And it sounded like the record. So people assumed that they were doing the records. That's how that all was.
Yeah.
Because all the group, they had to learn the record and play what we played. And so people said, well, it never crossed anybody's mind that they didn't do the records.
Right.
So the movie points that out.
Now, one of the things that Denny Tedesco talked about was licensing the music for this documentary, because it's filled with music. So that in and of itself was really a cost factor that kind of delayed the fuller release of this documentary for a long time. That goes into the whole business of, you know, you can't play it on the movie unless you actually license the song. How did he actually end up raising the final money for that? Do you know the backstory on that?
Well, a little bit. Well, he started to get sponsors, for one thing, that would put giving him enough money to do it. That bill for the publishers was hundreds of thousands of dollars. Right. You know? And people started to put, companies would started to put money in. He would auction off things. He sent me a bass Fender gave him, sent me to sign, and I mailed it back to him. He sent me a couple of guitars to sign and forward those on to the Nelson Twin. And he would sell things like that. But I think the big one was getting sponsors.
Yeah. Well, he also wrote that he tried something that's kind of modern. It's called crowdsourcing, and he used a group called Kickstarter that basically you go out to the audience, the potential audience, and say, would you fund this documentary? Then you get to see it. A lot of records are actually being made that way these days through crowdsourcing. You go to your audience, and they sponsor your production, which is very unique in this time and very different from the time and era that you were in. Yeah.
Well, I don't know any details about all that. He made it work, though, and it's a good thing.
Now, you'll be there tonight and tomorrow night to answer questions from the audience?
Yes.
Okay, so anybody who'd like to come out and maybe really dig into that era and the music and stuff like that, it'd be a great chance to also meet you and be a part of this documentary, and also to celebrate the music that came from what I call my era. You know, that was my formative years, is the 60s when I grew up with music. So, Joe, any final thoughts that you want to share with anybody?
And I'm doing all I can physically do to help Denny with this project. He's all over the country every day and working himself to death. I'm flying out Monday to Nashville for a screening up there with him. But I'll spend a couple of days with him doing interviews and stuff. And so whatever I can do to help is what I'm doing now.
All right. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was bassist Joe Osborne, a member of the legendary Wrecking Crew, who joined me in our Knoll Foundation studios today to talk about the documentary, The Wrecking Crew, and that opens up today at the Robinson Film Center. There's going to be special reception and Q&A tonight and tomorrow night at the 7:30 screening, and Joe will be on hand to field questions from the audience about the music and the times. Tickets are going fast. There's only a few tickets left for tonight's showing, and tomorrow night's showing is going to fill up quick, so you're encouraged to call ahead and get your reservations. For complete details, you can visit the Robinson Film Center online at robinsonfilmcenter.org or call 318-459-4122. That's 318-459-4122. We'll go out with one of the records that Joe played on. This is Let the Sunshine In from the Fifth Dimension Aquarius. You can hear the bass line going on in the background in this segment.